Monday morning you showed the fight. Good morning, NFL fans. Welcome to another episode of Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. I'm your host, Dave Holcomb. Week 4 just about in the books. We just have Monday Night Football left as of this recording. 6 teams on bye, so 13 games to go through, 12, not counting Monday Night Football. Plenty of action, even with a lot of great teams not playing. The Seahawks, the Broncos, the Bengals, the Cardinals. Even with all those teams out, we had some great action in Week 4. So we're going to get to all of that here on this episode of Monday Morning Huddle. We're going to start out focusing on two NFC teams that started out the year 1-2, but rebounded nicely in Week 4 to get back to that 500 mark and sitting pretty, not pretty after 4 weeks of the year, but they'll take a 2-2 record. Actually started last year 2-2, both these teams, and were able to make the playoffs. So they feel very comfortable where they're at right now. In the second segment, we're talking NFC South. All of a sudden, what many thought could be one of the best divisions, maybe the best division in football this year. The three quote-unquote best teams in the division all lost on Sunday. And the team that looked like they were the worst team in the league pulled off a huge upset on the road. That's the Tampa Bay Buccaneers beating the Steelers. So what is going on in the NFC South? We'll talk about that in our second segment. And then in our fourth and long segment, we'll talk further about Mike Glennon and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. But in the segment as a whole, focus on quarterbacks Glennon, Kirk Cousins, and Ryan Tannehill. But let's get started with those teams that I mentioned going 1-2 to start the season, but winning some big games in Week 4 to get to that 500 mark. First one, the San Francisco 49ers. The coaching staff called this a must-win. It was a game that I thought they weren't going to win, playing the Eagles, even at home. The Philadelphia Eagles, the best second-half team in the NFL through the first 3 weeks. The 49ers, the worst second-half team in the league through the first 3 weeks. And when you look at the statistics, it's amazing that this was even a close one. 49ers winning by 5, 26-21. Total yards, San Francisco, 407. Philadelphia Eagles, 213, almost 2-1. Rushing yards was just a joke. 49ers, 218 rushing yards. The Philadelphia Eagles, 22. Not 222, 22 rushing yards. First downs was almost 2-1. Niners 20, Eagles 11. Total plays, the Eagles, the offense at high flying, 80 offensive plays per game on average, right? Is that what they're averaging coming into Week 4? They had 56 plays on offense. San Francisco 76. The passing yards was really the only statistic that was even, with San Francisco 189 and the Philadelphia Eagles 191. And time of possession, well, Chip Kelly doesn't care about time of possession. He couldn't care less about that stat. And in many ways, he is right that it's an overrated stat. But I've gone on record before, we've talked about this last year. You can't just ignore the time of possession altogether. San Francisco controlled the ball for 42 minutes in this game. If you control the ball for 42 minutes in a game, that's going to lead to twice as many first downs, twice as many total yards, dominating the ground game, and ultimately winning the football game. And also what didn't help the Philadelphia Eagles, they turned the ball over 4 times. So all of those things were stacked in San Francisco's favor. It's amazing, again, that the Eagles were even able to make it a game, but Philadelphia jumped out, actually, to a 21-10 lead in the first half behind an interception return for a touchdown by Malcolm Jenkins and a punt return from a touchdown by Darren Sproles. It's hard to win if you're San Francisco and you're looking at this game and you're behind by 11 early on, and you're looking at a second half with a deficit like that, and you've only had 3 points, something like 3 or 6 points in the second half of three games combined, and you're looking at an 11-point deficit because of two touchdown returns, it's really hard to win when you give up those two touchdown returns. But you got to give San Francisco credit. They came in saying this was a must-win for them. And they played that way. They played with desperation. And the Zach Ertz fumble that they forced early on in the third quarter really tied or turned the tide of this game. The Eagles turned it over a couple more times in the second half. They began forcing it. The Eagles, with their inability to run the ball, really started to force it in the second half and got impatient, frustrated with the fact that they weren't making big plays. And you got to credit the 49er offense for forcing them into being frustrated and making bad decisions. It was really the second week in a row that Chip Kelly's offense was unable to run the ball. They were tried repeatedly with no success. I mean, that's a big reason why that the time of possession was so skewed in the 49ers' favor, because eventually Chip Kelly had to abandon the run. They were averaging less than 2 yards per rush. LeSean McCoy, 10 carries, 17 yards. It's the second straight week that he was held to under 2 yards per carry. Held to under 3 yards per carry just once last year. Never was he held under 2 yards per carry at all a season ago. Now two times, 2 weeks in a row. In a game where he received 10 or more carries in his career, LeSean McCoy, prior to this year, had only been held under 2 yards per carry twice. Again, it's happened this week and last week. It's now doubled the amount of times in LeSean McCoy's career. I can't blame LeSean McCoy. I can't blame the play calling on this one. It's the offensive line. The Eagles are in disarray up front on offense. Todd Harriman's is the only starting offensive lineman still left on the line by the end of the game on Sunday. Jason Peters left with an injury against San Francisco. He's their all-pro left tackle. And even with him on the field last week, they weren't able to run the ball. Jason Kelce left in the game last week against the Redskins. And pretty much after his exit, he's the center for the Eagles, starting center. Philadelphia was unable to run the ball. Harriman's, on top of all of the, you know, the fact that Harriman's is only the only starting offensive lineman left, he's playing out of position, normally plays right guard. He's been moved to right tackle. So there's really no starting offensive lineman, at least at their correct position, left for the Eagles, and that has contributed to this horrible, horrible rushing average for them the last 2 weeks. And you know, contrary to popular belief, Chip Kelly and the Eagles offense is focused on running the ball. They want to run the ball. Kelly wants to establish a running game. It's not like the old style running game, where you get a fullback, you run I formation, strong formation, up the middle, in between the tackles. That's not the way Chip Kelly runs his offense. Of course that's not it. But it's not always high-flying, passing, wide receiver screens, that kind of stuff. Trick plays. He does like to get LeSean McCoy, Darren Sproles the ball, halfback draws. He gets his playmakers the ball in space. And two of his playmakers, LeSean McCoy and Darren Sproles, have been completely ineffective behind this patchwork offensive line the last 2 weeks. This is just killing the Chip Kelly offense. And it didn't kill him any more at any point in the game on Sunday, bigger than it did at the end of the game. 2 minute warning, third and goal at the one. The Eagles have the ball. Down by 5, touchdown, gives them the lead with under 2 minutes to go. San Francisco didn't have any timeouts left. They didn't run the ball. Two incomplete passes. And, you know, maybe you could argue that is a time where you kind of wish that Chip Kelly's offense had a fullback or had an I formation play to be a little bit more effective in goal line situations. But for the most part, when he has a healthy offensive line, he can run McCoy or Darren Sproles in a shotgun halfback draw type play and get into the end zone. But it was apparent by the fact that he called two pass plays, third and goal at the one, he had no confidence that his offensive line was going to be able to get a push up front. And that was even more surprising because on second and goal from the six, LeSean McCoy's number was called on a halfback draw and ran it to the one. So I figured, at least when I was watching the game, that Chip Kelly would at least roll the dice once with McCoy on third down or fourth down. But no, he elected to throw the ball twice. Both passes fell incomplete. The 49ers, as mentioned, this was a must-win for them. They fell behind early, even though they didn't give up a score on defense. Got to give them credit. They played very well, forced four turnovers. Even though you can credit a lot of the running woes for the Eagles to their offensive line, the San Francisco 49ers played very well to stop that run. And making a team one-dimensional, no matter how good of an offense they are, is always a key to success. And also you got to give credit to Colin Kaepernick and the 49ers offense coming back in this game. The defense gave them short fields, gave them opportunities to win the game, but give credit to Kaepernick and the San Francisco offense capitalizing on those opportunities. Another team that came into Sunday 1-2 and had something to prove, especially on the offensive side of the ball, the Green Bay Packers. Aaron Rodgers told us this week that Packer fans, Aaron Rodgers fantasy owners, everybody just needed to relax a little bit on the Packers offense. And boy, was he correct. Rodgers, 22 of 28, 302 yards, 4 touchdowns. You know, we learned as much today about the Packers and their offense and what they're going to be able to do the rest of the year as we did about the Seahawks defense, the Lions defense, and the Jets defense. I think it's time that we give credit to those defenses for slowing down Aaron Rodgers. You know, when it happens 3 weeks in a row, you don't want to give credit to the Green Bay Packers. You know, we just talked about how the Eagles haven't run the ball effectively now 2 weeks in a row. Still have to give credit to the 49ers for stopping that running game, and I think I justly did that, talking about the 49ers' defense in the previous discussion. Got to do the same thing with the Jets defense, the Lions defense. They've proved that they are very effective stopping the passing game, no matter who it is. The Jets held Calvin Johnson to 2 catches on Sunday. So it's not a huge surprise against a patchwork Bears defense that Aaron Rodgers went off for 4 touchdowns. His 2 biggest targets of the day, his wide receivers, Jordy Nelson, Randall Cobb. Nelson, 10 catches, 108 yards, 2 touchdowns. Cobb finally involved in the offense in a big way. 7 catches, 113 yards, also caught 2 touchdowns. Eddie Lacy, a little bit more effective, just enough really to keep a little bit of balance for that Green Bay offense. Ultimately, they need more from their running back, but Lacy, 17 carries, 48 yards, not a very good average, 2.8 per carry, but he did have a touchdown. The Bears' offense looked just as good as the Packers' offense did in the first half. Second half was a different story. The Bears fell behind in the second half. The Packers started with the ball, had a first half lead at halftime, and then scored on their first possession of the second half. It seemed like Cutler kind of regressed a little and turned into the Cutler of old, pressing a little bit, making bad decisions because his team was behind. He didn't do that against San Francisco when they were behind, but he did it on Sunday against the Packers, forcing balls into tight windows, threw 2 interceptions in the third quarter, and that's really when the game got out of hand. I liked the Bears' game plan initially in this game. 19 of their first 33 plays were runs, and Matt Forte had a really good day, 122 yards, 171 total yards, 28 touches. He had 5 catches, 23 carries in all. Backup running back Kareem Carey also rushed for 72 yards on 14 carries. But ultimately, partially because they fell behind in this game, but they didn't stick with that running game. In the second half, when you're only behind by a touchdown, rather than Cutler throwing it all over the yard and forcing it to throw an interception, stick with what's working. Stick with Matt Forte. A good amount of those carries were in the first half. I know maybe you don't want to rack up 30 touches for Forte in one game. Maybe health is a concern. But if the game is on the line in the second half, you got to continue to give Forte the ball when he has the hot hand. I felt like they abandoned Forte a little bit too early when they fell behind. The Bears felt the pressure certainly to keep up with the Packers' offense when they went to the attack. And the Bears' wide receivers, it's still clear that they're not healthy enough to make big plays like Randall Cobb and Jordy Nelson did. They did have some big plays. Jeffrey caught a touchdown. Brandon Marshall caught a touchdown. But other than that, they combined for 59 receiving yards. That's not getting it done when Aaron Rodgers is going to throw for 302 yards, 4 touchdowns. You know, when you're in a shootout, you need guys like Jeffrey and Marshall to come up big. Ultimately, I would say it was the Bears' defense that has really, you know, struggled so far this year, struggled in this game. We saw Detroit and the New York Jets very effective. Jets maybe less so, but the Jets, particularly the Lions, effective in slowing down that Aaron Rodgers offense and the passing attack. The Bears weren't able to do that. And a huge credit has to, or huge detriment for the Bears has to go to the fact that they were missing a ton of players on defense. 4 starters: Jared Allen, Jay Ratliff, Shea McClellan, and Sherrick McManus. A lot of Irish guys in there, you would think, with those names. But with those guys out, very little pass rush, and the secondary was unable to stay with Nelson and Cobb the whole day. So just like the 49ers, the Packers proved their doubters wrong on Sunday. Both teams are now 2-2. Both teams were 2-2 last year and made the playoffs, the 49ers as a wild card. Green Bay came back to win the NFC North last year, actually won the last game of the season at Soldier Field, where they won on Sunday. I think the Packers proved as much as the 49ers did. The 49ers are in a really tough division, so it's hard to say that they'll come back and win the division with the Cardinals undefeated and the Super Bowl champs in the division, and still 3 more games against those 2 teams. But the Packers, even though I like what the Bears have done so far, and I like the Lions, and even the Vikings at 2-2 are threatening, the Packers are the team that really is the team to beat in that division. They're not going anywhere, and they proved that on Sunday. The Bears, on the other hand, 2 great road wins, but they dropped 2 heartbreakers at home to the Bills in week 1 and now to their arch rival. We've seen this from Chicago before with Mark Trestman and even at the end of the era with Lovie Smith. Inconsistent play from Jay Cutler and inconsistent play as a whole from the entire team. I'm not ruling them out yet. They are definitely in the playoff race and in the division conversation for the NFC North title. But they need to get healthy on defense and at wide receiver to really be a true threat in the NFC. For you fantasy football players out there, there is a tremendous opportunity in Week 5 affiliated with Football Nation, one of the sister sites, ffchamps.com, in combination with DraftKings, is offering $1 million. $1 million. To the first place winner in week 5, a competition that you can enter. There's a limited number of spots, $27 to play. First place gets $1 million. In order to sign up, go to the link I'm pulling up the link here, ffchamps.com/million. $1 million. Just $27 to play. It's a tremendous opportunity. If you play fantasy football, if you're a casual football, fantasy football fan, or diehard, you got to be in this competition. ffchamps.com/million. Win $1 million this weekend. Play for just $27. We're going to take a break on the show. We'll be back with our NFC South discussion. They go 1-3 this weekend, and the team you would think would get blown out actually got a victory. Welcome back to Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. I'm your host, Dave Holcomb. I want to hear what you think about the show. Tweet at me, DM, HOLCOMB. Send me an email, holcombmdavid@gmail.com. Or find me on Facebook, Dave's Football News. You know, you might not be able to find me on Facebook in a month or so. I read somewhere that Facebook is now going to charge $3 to anybody that wants to have an account. Oh, that's a good idea. Let's just retroactively start charging people for something that they already have for free. I'm not keeping my Facebook account. Actually, I really would like to keep it. I like it. But is it worth $4 a month? I don't know. I don't think so. It's not worth that to me. But anyway, before that happens, send me a Facebook message, Dave's Football News. And don't forget, as always, you can leave a comment on the page where you're probably listening to this podcast. I love hearing from everybody that's listening out there. So let's move into NFC South discussion. We're going to talk about the three teams that lost, three of the four teams that lost in the NFC South on Sunday. We'll talk about the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in the fourth and long segment. But the Falcons, Saints, and Panthers all losing on Sunday. And what was turning into what I thought would be a really tightly contested division. You figured at the beginning of the year, I thought the Saints were going to be the team to beat. I thought the Saints would win the division. That was my pick. Carolina looked really good in the first 2 weeks. Atlanta, after the first 2 weeks, 1-1, they actually beat the Saints at home. Okay, so after the first 3 weeks, Carolina laid a dud at home to the Steelers. You thought they still would be the team to beat. I thought they were going to beat the Ravens, actually. Atlanta was 2-1, and New Orleans finally won their first game. They were 1-2. All three of them losing now is turning into the NFC South is you know, I don't want to say it's one of the worst divisions. I mean, it could change in just a week or two again, but it's just a huge surprise to have, you know, no team with a winning record at this point, 25% through the season. Let's talk Panthers first. 2-0 after the first 2 weeks. They looked like they were the team to beat in the NFC South. They beat Tampa Bay with Derek Anderson. Cam Newton came back, played well. They beat the Lions, who I think is a contender in the NFC North. But without a healthy running back the last 2 weeks, and they had couple healthy running backs, but they all left with injuries against the Steelers. D'Angelo Williams started on Sunday against the Ravens, but he left in the second quarter as well. So without a healthy running back the entire game, you know, they finished the game with rookie Darren Reeves as their go-to running back. That's not going to get it done for you, especially when you're a team that wants to run the ball. Carolina is built to run the ball, get a lead, and play defense. They can't play defense as effectively without a lead. They're not built to come back. And it's very evident because the defense is getting gashed for big plays. They got gashed on the ground against the Steelers, and then the Ravens, and with their air attack, just completely shredded the Panthers. Flacco threw for 327 yards. Steve Smith had six catches. Excuse me, Steve Smith Sr. He had a kid over the offseason, and he's Steve Smith Jr., so he wants to be called Senior. Seven catches, 139 yards, two touchdowns. So even though there was chaos in the Ravens' backfield, Bernard Pierce coming back from the injury, but he started but didn't get a carry. Just giving fantasy owners headaches with that one. Justin Forsett, 14 carries, 66 yards, and a touchdown. The rookie, Lorenzo Taylor-Ferro. I just learned this week how to pronounce his name. I think I got it right. Taylor-Ferro, 15 carries, 58 yards, and a touchdown as well. So that headache will likely continue with fantasy owners, with anybody with the running back in that backfield. But with getting back to the Panthers for a second, they gave up, you know, the 66 and 58 yards to the two running backs from the Ravens, and then the 327 passing yards. But with no running game, they can't do what they want. They can't control the pace of the game. They can't get out to a lead. They can't control the clock. They can't play defense as effectively. Now, Williams, like I said, left in the second quarter with an ankle injury. Before he left, he did run the ball 11 times for 34 yards. But as a whole, the Panthers finished with 26 carries for 67 yards. That's not going to get it done. When you want to win games by running the ball, that's not going to get it done. It also doesn't help Carolina that Cam Newton is just not himself. And I think it's because of whether it's his injured ankle or his ribs are still bothering him. I don't know. But he is not himself out there. He was 14 of 25, 197 yards through the air, a touchdown, was sacked twice, just 7 rushing yards. They need to get him healthy. And it is not a recipe to getting him healthy with him taking so many hits like he has the last 2 weeks. The Steelers got to him with their blitzing. The Ravens got to him probably even worse with their pass rushers. And Newton on the ground a lot. That's not what you want to see out of your running quarterback. You want him upright, running around, and healthy. And without an effective running game, like I said, no healthy runner, the pass rushers are just able to tee off, and they're getting to Newton and causing a lot of distress for the guy. The New Orleans Saints were a team that I thought would probably join the 49ers and Packers in our first segment as teams coming into the week 1-2 and proved that they're still a team to be reckoned with. And as they got back to the 500 mark, not to be, as they got blown out against the Dallas Cowboys, 38-17. Tell you what, the Dallas defense, I'm not going to say they're for real. I don't want to say that they're a dominating defense by any means. But they were just ridiculed last year as one of the worst defenses around. Gave up 40 first downs to the Saints on Sunday Night Football last year. They held the Saints offense to 0 points in the first half. It was the largest deficit any Sean Payton Saints team has faced in his tenure as coach. I guess minus the 2012 season, that goes all the way back to 2006. The Cowboys in this game forced 3 turnovers, recovered 2 fumbles, and picked off a pass in the first half off Drew Brees. That was a That interception led to a touchdown for the Cowboy offense and really started the game well. And the Cowboys really built momentum off of that turnover. It was the Jimmy Graham fumble really in many ways sealed the victory as the Saints had a chance to come back. But were in the red zone. They were driving. But Graham's fumble likely took 7, I don't want to say likely 7, but at least 3 points off the board for the Saints. It could have been a 7 or 10 point swing. Tony Romo throwing the ball really well in this one. 22 of 29, 262 yards, 3 touchdowns. He is so much more effective when he realizes, we talked about this with Jay Cutler, when Romo realizes it doesn't have to fall on him. The team can play defense. DeMarco Murray can run the ball effectively. He just makes so much better decisions, throwing 3 touchdowns in this one, no interceptions. DeMarco Murray, 24 carries, 149 yards, 2 touchdowns. He has another monster game. He's having an incredible start to the 2014 season. And if everybody else can continue to play well, and Romo can can let his teammates help him and can fall back on them. He is such a better quarterback. You know, and I'm not saying that he has to be a game manager. I'm not saying that he can't throw the ball around like Peyton Manning or a Aaron Rodgers or Philip Rivers, if we've seen him do this season. He can do that and win games. But he can't do that all by himself. He can't be the only guy effective on his team. You know, you don't think Peyton Manning gets help? You don't think Aaron Rodgers and Philip Rivers are getting help? Of course they're getting help. Whether it's from the defense or from receivers, they're getting help. And in years past, Romo has not gotten that needed help. He's getting it so far this year, and the Cowboys are 3-1. Murray, let's go back to him for a second. I mentioned the 24 carries. He is on pace for 396 carries. That is incredible. A great mark. DeMarco Murray, fantasy owners love it. My only concern is, can he stay healthy? The guy has never played a full 16-game schedule before. He's on pace for 400 carries, 432 touches in all. You know, there will be a big question mark what the Cowboys will become if at any point Murray suffers an injury. And the way Murray's career has gone, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And I'm not saying that Romo needs to take over the offense just in case an injury happens. But I'm just worried that for this Cowboy offense, this Cowboys team, what will happen to them if Murray ends up suffering an injury. But until that happens, if it does, ride out this hot streak and continue to let Murray carry you to victories. As for the Saints, I mentioned the three turnovers. The Jimmy Graham fumble really cost them in the red zone. They were able to cut the deficit to 14 halfway through the fourth quarter, and Sean Payton elected to go with a fake punt. You know, the Saints pull out these trick plays and such a lot, and they usually work, but Payton and the Saints really, on Sunday night and the entire season so far, not pushing the right buttons, not making the right calls. Just, it's been a bad season for them so far, and they would be the first ones to tell you that. In that situation, of course, hindsight is 20/20, but wouldn't you rather have Drew Brees try and complete a pass than your punter on 4th and 9? You know, and that really, the momentum that the Cowboys then gained from that, they went down and scored a touchdown, and the game was over. You worked so hard to get the deficit to just 14. I think you would punt the ball away there and hope that you can stop them and have enough time to score quickly with about maybe 6 minutes left in the game if you can force a 3-and-out. Or you go for 4th down with Drew Brees on the field and your offense, not your punter. For the Saints, they're lucky that no one has distinguished themselves yet in this division. They're only a game back of first place. And they've only lost one division game so far. So they're very much still involved. The Atlanta Falcons in Minnesota. The takeaway points I have for the Falcons from Sunday, it's pretty clear that Atlanta is a completely different team at the Georgia Dome. They average 19 points on offense on the road, as opposed to 46.5 at home. Of course, the opponents that they've faced at home affect that. You know, they play Tampa Bay and New Orleans at home. Not great defenses. But and on the road, they played the Bengals, a very good defense, and then the Vikings, I'll say middle-of-the-road defense so far through 4 games. So that, of course, is affecting it. But that's a huge difference, 19 points versus 46.5. I don't care who you're playing. That's a big difference. The defense is also better at home. They average 24 points allowed at home. On the road, they give up 32.5. They couldn't stop the Viking rushing attack on Sunday, even though Adrian Peterson was not playing. Viking running backs, 44 carries for 241 yards. The rookie Teddy Bridgewater in his first start threw for 317 yards. So, like we thought at the beginning of the season, it was the Falcons' defense that was really suspect against the Vikings. two late interceptions from Matt Ryan really did end the Falcons. He played a very well up until probably 5 minutes, 7 or 8 minutes maybe left in the fourth quarter. Up to that point, he played very well. And perhaps, you know, he threw those interceptions because he's trying to force the ball. He's trying to make something happen late at the game, late in the game with his team trailing. So that I won't fault Matt Ryan for that completely. But going forward, you know, this is what we're going to get from the Falcons all year. You know, they're going to be a middle-of-the-road team, 8-8, 9-7. I don't think they're a playoff team unless they win this weak division. Looks like it's going to be a weak division. And they have to win with their offense. They have to outscore people. And it's much easier for them to outscore people at home. We're going to take another break here on Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. When we come back, we will stay with the NFC South with our first statement in the fourth and long segment, talking Mike Glennon and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Welcome back to Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. I'm your host, Dave Holcomb. Want to tweet at me, DM, HOLCOMB. Send me an email, holcombmdavid@gmail.com, or find me on Facebook. It's still free as of right now. Dave's Football News. Want to love to hear from you guys out there. We're talking quarterbacks, specifically young quarterbacks, in our fourth and long segment, starting with Mike Glennon of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Had a horrible first half against the Steelers on Sunday, but came back, threw for 302 yards, 21 of 42 passing, 2 touchdowns, 1 pick, and the game-winning touchdown with 7 seconds left to Vincent Jackson. My statement, Mike Glennon must remain the quarterback for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers for the rest of the season. We discussed this with our guest last week, Daniel Hutchinson, and I think he would say the same thing as he did last week, that Glennon should have been starting from opening day. And, you know, I could probably make that argument here. Josh McCown, not very effective, 35 years old, came in. He was named the starter from day one, not really sure why. You know, you can make that argument that he shouldn't have been. I'm just going to argue that, yes, Glennon should be the starter the rest of the year. You know, I don't care what he does next week or the week after. Glennon is the future. McCown is 35 years old. This is supposed to be an up-and-coming team, a team on the rise. It's hard to be a team on the rise with a 35-year-old quarterback. You know, McCown is a journeyman. He's played with so many different teams. He had a great run with the Bears last year, throwing for a ton of yards, although they didn't win all that many of the games he started, which I think is important to notice. He didn't win that many games. And he's not going to repeat that performance because, A, he doesn't have Brandon Marshall and Alshon Jeffrey anymore, and, two, that was the best stretch of his 10-year career. He's not going to be able to repeat that. If he, you know, quarterbacks don't peak at 35. It doesn't happen. He was playing out of his mind last year, mostly because of the receivers he was throwing to. That's not going to happen again. So, of course, there's a lot of negatives around McCown, but as Sunday proved, there's a lot of positives around Glennon. That's now his third game-winning touchdown of his very young career. He showed last year that he can be a starter and win in the league. He went on the road in a tough place to play, Heinz Field, and beat what's supposed to be a pretty tough opponent. And I say supposed to be because we get a different Steelers team every week. But, you know, the Steelers are going to be there probably at the end of the season. They're going to struggle week in and week out. They're going to be inconsistent, but at the end of the day, I think the Steelers will be in playoff contention. So this is a big win for the young quarterback. He should remain the starter the whole year. Another guy that is in discussion about whether he will keep his starting job or relinquish it back to the starter on opening day, and that's Kirk Cousins, the Washington Redskins. My statement, Cousins' four interception night on Thursday against the Giants significantly hurts his chances of remaining the starting quarterback in Washington. Look, of course it does. Yes, I'm grunting on that. It does. The media is eating him alive this weekend and this week. And it doesn't help Cousins that he has an extra few days to think about his awful performance because he has 10 or 11 days to prepare. Actually, I think he has even more than that because the Redskins are playing on Monday night next week. So we're not even going to be able to discuss Cousins and the Redskins next week. But I don't care what anybody says about RG3 and his health or Cousins throwing four interceptions on Thursday. All quarterbacks have bad games. Cousins is the future of the Washington Redskins. Griffin cannot stay healthy. And when he is healthy, he is not the same quarterback as his rookie year. You know, Griffin was a great quarterback, or he was a great quarterback his rookie year because of his playmaking ability and his ability to run out of the pocket and make plays. Because of his health, the offensive coordinator and the new head coach, Jay Gruden, they don't want him doing that. They don't want him running the ball, moving out of the pocket. They want him to be a pocket passer, which he's just not very good at. Cousins is. He had a bad game on Thursday. It happens to everybody. One thing that I think Cousins should improve on, and he can improve on it immediately, his confidence was noticeably shaken after that first interception. And then he threw a second one in the third quarter. And he walks or runs back to the sideline with his head down. It obviously affects him probably more than I've seen any other quarterback in a long time. He's got to put a bad play behind him. He's going to make bad plays. It's the best players that put those bad plays behind them and can make big plays to come back in games or keep their teams in games after making mistake after mistake. Don't let mistakes pile up because your confidence is shaken. That's what I want to see from Kirk Cousins in his next game. Can he find that poise again that he had against the Eagles in week 3? Our last statement, we're going to Miami, who was actually in London over the weekend. They beat up on the Raiders. Obviously, they feel great about the victory, but it's been a hectic week for the Miami Dolphins. Last week, head coach Joe Philbin failed to endorse quarterback Ryan Tannehill to the media as his starting quarterback, even though he told Tannehill he's the starting quarterback and continued to give him the first team reps in practice, thus creating his own quarterback controversy. It's just head coaches always, you know, their nightmare is a quarterback controversy, the media, you know, making a controversy out of nothing. Philbin was the one making a controversy out of nothing. Did you really want to start Matt Moore over Ryan Tannehill? I know Tannehill hasn't played well this year, but come on. That's a come on, man. So last week on Wednesday, Tannehill actually came forward, told the media that he will start, and that he was bothered by the way his head coach handled the entire situation. He also mentioned the locker room was bothered by it because it was a distraction for the entire team. Philbin apologized later on in the week, but the relationship between Philbin and Tannehill seems to obviously be eroded. And my statement, the Philbin-Tannehill relationship will continue to erode this season, leaving ownership the choice of the quarterback or the coach at the end of the year. I'm grunting on this as well. I'm grunting for a third time. Obviously, as I mentioned at the top of this discussion, the Dolphins winning big against the Raiders in London will put a smile on everybody's face for 1 week. I don't see this going away. This is going to continue to fester unless the Dolphins make the playoffs. That would solve everything. If the Dolphins make the playoffs, I think Philbin keeps his job and Ryan Tannehill, you know, starts to get mentioned as perhaps not an elite quarterback, but a quarterback that can play effectively in this league. If they miss the playoffs, which I think they will. I think they'll miss the playoffs. One, because I don't think they're better than San Diego or Baltimore. And two, I don't see them winning this division. It's still New England's division to lose in my mind. And because of that, Miami will not make the playoffs and thus have to make some major, major changes this offseason. And I would say they stay with Tannehill. I'm not completely sold on him. I said in the offseason that I thought the way that they built this team really hurt Tannehill's development. Yes, they brought in Mike Wallace, but they didn't have an offensive line in front of him to effectively use Wallace as a weapon. Tannehill got crushed last year, hit all the time. That weighs on a young quarterback, taking that many hits. You get shell-shocked after a while. I thought Ryan Tannehill might be shell-shocked coming into this year. Perhaps that has led to his poor play, even though the offensive line has been better. So I'm not sold on Tannehill, but if the Dolphins miss the playoffs, it's Joe Philbin who will go. The entire controversy with the offensive line last year with Jonathan Martin and Richie Incognito, and now this, Philbin, his reputation around the league is taking a major hit, and the only way he can save his job, in my mind, would be to make the playoffs. One more song from Led Zeppelin. We're taking one more break, then we'll come back and wrap up today's show. And we're back here on Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle, your host, Dave Holcomb. One more time, send me a tweet, Holcomb M. David. No, that's my email. DM, HOLCOMB is my Twitter. My email, HolcombMDavid@gmail.com. Facebook, it's still free as of right now. Dave's Football News. Three articles I want you to check out on the site this week. From our guest from last week, Daniel Hutchinson, Tampa Bay shocks Pittsburgh. Three things we learned. David Levin, I always give you something from him, one of our best authors on the site. His article called Miami Beats Oakland 38-14, Three Things We Learned. We just finished discussing Ryan Tannehill. I bet at some point Levin talks about the controversy going on between Tannehill and his head coach Philbin. And from a relatively new author on the site, Cody Parker, he discusses a topic that we easily could have put into the show last week. The NFL needs to change their overtime rule. That's the title of his article. That's in reference to the Broncos and Seahawks game of last week that saw the Broncos offense not get to go on the field in overtime. Some people were saying that it was unfair because you didn't get to see Peyton Manning take the field again in overtime. Personally, I thought it's perfectly fine. That's the rule. If you want Peyton Manning to take the field, then don't let the Seahawks offense score. It's pretty easy. But anyway, one more time I want to remind you, fantasy football players out there, huge opportunity this weekend. $1 million to the winner at DraftKings.com. You want to sign up for it? It's $27. You get a free subscription to FF Champs, Football Nation's sister website. Go to ffchamps.com/million. Play to win $1 million in fantasy football this week. No commitments other than this coming weekend, week 5. Pick your team just based on the matchups for week 5. If you win $1 million to you, great opportunity there. Other reminders, remember my article, my slideshow will come out, my power ranking slideshow on Tuesday morning, so look out for that. And I will have some other work on the site. I hope to have some other work on the site this coming week as well. Actually, maybe very, very premature playoff picture article. I've done that the last couple of years every 4 weeks of the season. So we're at the four-week mark, 25% done with the year. So that first installment of that article could be out this week as well. That's it for this edition of Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. Until next week, I'm going to go try and find some peace in my mind.